Hello, good afternoon. We're going to start right on time since you're all here, and our panelists are glad you're here. They promise that the conference saved the best for the last. And we have four presentations. We'll stick with the 15 minutes per presentation, and then we'll all come up on stage for a conversation, which ought to be lively, given the point of the session is to bring up controversial perspectives and conundrums, so we can dig into them at the end. The first speaker is Rita Pakvelin, and the topic is Beyond Queer, Queering Finnish Archives and Museums from an Intersectional Perspective. She is the Executive Director of Culture for All Service, addressing queer issues through projects such as Queering the Museums and Finland 100 in Rainbow Colors. She holds a PhD in literature and has worked as university lecturer and researcher. As an activist, she was one of the main organizers of the LGBTQ Culture Festival, the Nights and Days of the Tribids. She is widely published in all of these themes. Please welcome her.
Thank you for the presentation, and thank you all for being here. I'll try now to get the Mac working. I'm not a Mac person, so. We practiced this. Okay, just before I go into queering museums and archives, I want to introduce where I come from, because it's plays a role in how we work with these issues. My organization is called Culture for All, as you heard, and we are a state-funded organization with the mission to support the art and culture sector in questions concerning diversity and accessibility. So queering archives and museums is not only the only thing we do. We try to work with, or we started out as an organization within the National Gallery, or as a part of the National Gallery, and in the beginning it was accessibility that was our aim. So from working only with accessibility, we slowly began an organization working with diversity, inclusion in all its forms within the whole culture and art sector in the whole Finland. So that is the background, but so we are working towards state-funded organizations, and now I'm going to talk about publicly and state-funded organizations and how we are working with them. And we also have our organization, our association that was funded in 2013 has 16 member organizations that are all umbrella organizations within the Finnish arts and culture field. But since 2012, when I became the director, we started to work very consciously with LGBTIQ issues, and especially within museums, libraries, archives, the stage and performative arts and visual arts. The first thing we did was to work where we were. So we, as a member, or so as a part of the National Gallery, we thought that, okay, we start with working within the National Gallery. And the Finnish National Gallery consists out of three museums, three buildings. So it's a huge, huge museums, with a lot of different artifacts and images and loads of archival material. And also with very different kind of, people working within an organization as well. So we started with a project that we, at that moment, we didn't start with having a project, but we started with working, and then afterwards we realized, okay, this is a project. And we didn't get any external funding for it, but we used our own funding for it. And in the beginning, I was cooperating with two people I knew within the arts and culture sector who was very interested in queering their institutions, or not their institutions, but queering the art sector. Katrina Rosavara, who's an artist and art educator and queer artist, an activist, a queer activist was the last one. And Kim Amberla, who is a producer at the National Opera. So I started with meeting with them and thinking about what do we want to do, which are the fields that we want to work with. And then we decided that, we need to know, or I need to know, what are the expectations within the LGBT community? How do they feel, or we feel, about the art sector? Art sector is often seen, or it's says about itself that it's open for everybody, but when you go into the institutions, you see that a lot of the things that, for example, in the theater sector, now with Me Too campaign, you see that theater performative arts, it's not only about the harassment towards women, or it's a harassment towards a lot of different minorities. So, for example, in the opera where Kim was working, everybody knew that a lot of people are queer, but nobody was open about it, and it was not something that they were dealing with within the opera. So we took part in Pride, by taking part in Pride, we also made the survey to collect answers from the audiences, and we got about around 190 answers to our questionnaires, and out of that we made a report to sort of show what kind of problems there are, what are the limitations, what are the thresholds, what are the expectations, desires, and out of that I started to work with doing different things within the our organization, how we work with. So the Helsinki Pride, that was the first time that the National Art Gallery took part in Pride, and we had some difficulties all the art museum leaders, directors, they were in it, they were supporting the things I did. But there were some people in the middle or somewhere that were not so happy about it. So, for example, we ordered all Pride, the rainbow flags to all the museums, and they were supposed to be there for the whole week. And then there was one person in the middle of the organization that a producer who ordered all the flags to be taken down, because the museum has agreed not to have any other commercial flags hanging outside of the museum. And that was this is now, Pride is on in Helsinki. Today was the Gay Pride Day, the parade. And so it's in the middle also of vacation time. So all the directors and all the people I've been working with were not there anymore. So it took me 3 days to get the flags back, because she was the contact to the people who were dealing with the flags. And so that is one of the things that suddenly came up. But the positive thing was that the museum got so much response, so positive response. For example, the Contemporary Art Museum had never gotten so much response in feedback on Facebook. So everybody liked the fact that they have flags outside of the museums. And now, of course, every year the museum has flags again. So just the rainbow visibility was important, but especially the queer-guided tours became very, very popular that we had. And then we also we started to educate the staff. After Pride, we arranged different kind of educational programs, because we were, at that time, we were part of the development part of the museum, so that was our true task also, to educate and to work with the staff and find ways to educate them. And that was important. And we were working together with Unstraight Museum in Stockholm. Some of you have probably heard Pia Lasker's presentation and discussion on that. And then we arranged in the end a national Queering Archives and Museum seminar. And we also produced a virtual guide to the National Gallery that is in Swedish, Finnish, and English, and you can see it online. So this is the queer guide. It's quite a nice guide. It's Juha-Heikki Tihinen, who is an art historian who has written the text, but we, together with him, we selected images and themes that we thought that should be in it. But what we learned from working with the museum was that we really have to mainstream the queer thinking within the museum organization and within the whole museum organization, that we have to find a way to reach the whole, everybody who is working with different tasks within the organization. This was a part of a larger diversifying and accessibility strategy within the museum, so it's not only this what we did, but it's really important that to get it within the whole organization, that everybody is in it, and to have all kinds of policies and action plans. The museum's directors are the starting point, but as my failure to include the whole staff was showed, that they are the starting point, but then you need to find a way to communicate it. If they don't do it in the organization themselves, I sort of trusted that there was this kind of network that the people I was dealing with, that they were. It wasn't only the directors that I talked to, but I still didn't reach this one person who took down all the flags. But inclusion also means new ways of thinking and doing, and it's not only having pride. And what I really found out, or not found out, this is something I've been thinking about a lot, but it became very clear that we need not to just hang everything on pride. We have to find a way to say, okay, we start with pride, how do we do it the rest of the year? Because it's pride, there is a lot of things happening. It can't be. Everybody's on vacation, and so we can't hang it on pride. And it's also important to follow up, to see what has happened afterwards in the organization, and to need to budget for equality. It should always be in the budget. Equality and accessibility should always be in the yearly annual budget. Otherwise, then people might say, okay, we don't have money for this. I just read one of the quotes before going to another one. We got a lot of, we collected information about how people felt about the queering the museum, and one said, queering is needed, especially in the Finnish National Museum. Now I get the feeling that they have constructed a heterosexual Finnish story in which I do not belong. People were saying that they were not going to museums because they were not included. And that, let's go to the national story then. Finland turned 100, became independent 2017, and we, together with CEPA, which is the National Gay and Lesbian and Trans Organization, LGBTIQ organization in Finland, decided to do something for the year, and we wanted to contact to reach out to the art organizations, and because we have a good network, we work with them all. Then we decided, okay, that we will, we will make this call to do something about it. But in order to have the voice, just before I go to the next slide, I just say this is the Pride House of this year in Finland. This is the National Museum, and this was I heard in the beginning of the week people were so happy, so. That they took part in Pride. This is like a major thing. So we did it. We had some main partners because we thought that if we send out a letter to all the art organizations, good that we say that, okay, we have all the national organizations behind us. So we had everything from the National Gallery, which is, of course, obvious, easy. But then all the national the two national theaters, we had archives, even the broadcasting company archive with us. And then we were cooperating with maybe 20, 30 art organizations throughout Finland from the south to the north. And I was giving a lot of helping them with really concrete things, and in some instances I would comment upon their exhibitions, or I would give suggestions on how they could do queering their programs. And then we were cooperating with scholars, many of them who are here, like Tuula Juvonen, Kati Mustola, and then another one, Riikka Taavetti, but also artists. So we had three aims, making visible, making the history of LGBTIQ plus people visible as part of the national narrative. And we did that with through different kind of museum cooperation, blogs, discussions, trainings, and so forth, seminars. Then we did collect new information on the queer history and the daily life of LGBTIQ plus minorities, and that was done through archival cooperation, different kind of memory cafes that we arranged together with archives and other institutions, museums, discussions, archival seminars, many seminars we had. And then we approached art and culture from a queer perspective, both helping them to museums to arrange queer guided tours, but even theaters to arrange queer guided tours to their art house, but also through the cooperation of different artists. And we wanted to this year to go beyond the obvious. Here is two of the icons of Finnish queer history and queer art. Tove Jansson, who is a writer, and Tom of Finland. Well, that's probably not something you need to know. You need to have an explanation. And both of them happen to be stamps, and they are becoming really commodified. And they are also, and Tove is finally being queer as well. But you can also see the difference between queering a woman and then the male. But we wanted to go beyond the binaries as well, and beyond these stories, because these are so easy for institutions to take on. We produced a web page where you get information. We have in the web page, it was in three languages, but now it's lost, so it's here in Swedish. There's a blog with all kinds of text that we order from researchers, writers, artists, and so on. Toolbox, Verktyg tools, then how to make your museums, archives, theaters queer. And then where we ask organizations to send their events or happenings, and then you could see on the calendar what was going on in Finland at a given time, and then the memory collection. And now I'm going to go really quickly because I have to end. But I will go back to that. We collected, we did a queer history collecting project together with a Swedish literary society, and to collect the history of the Swedish-speaking minority in Finland, a queer memory history. And this is the memory cafes we did, cards to be used in those, and this is the art project, and this is another one, just 20 seconds. Queer Cachet was an art project with Kalle Ham and Jamil Kamanger. You know the cachet, the geo cachet, and so they did a public work together. How do you say? I don't know what it calls, but you know they had a working group with people, and together with them they thought about the minority within the minorities. What are the special questions, the special places? And then they hid it in Helsinki. And so the Romani, the people with disabilities, the different, but also we also talked about homo nationalism and racism within the community and where in Helsinki that had been. I will go in the discussion. I can come back to the challenges and insights that we got from this one. And this is the Sami population, which is so invisible in the Finnish history. And these are art pieces made by the newcomers. And it all ended up that we then, after the year, we decided that we start with Queer History Month. And maybe we can go back to that. And this is all. Thank you.
Okay. Next is Vladislav Zygmunt Lender. The will to preserve is collecting queer. And just briefly, he's a board member of the Society for Queer Memory in Prague. He teaches 20th century art history, and he's an accomplished author and exhibit curator.
Thank you so much for your introduction. Thank you. I'm not a Mac person either, so let's see how that goes.
I have no idea how to start it, sorry.
Okay, thank you. Hello, everyone. Thanks for staying here, and thanks for coming to this panel. So I'm here on behalf of two institutions, the Department of History and Theory of Art at my university, which is paying for it. But what I'm really going to present here is what we do and what challenges we face in the Society for Queer Memory, which we started about 6 years ago in Prague. It's institutions. It's a non-profit organization and institution, a non-governmental institution. However, we do get some funding from the city of Prague, some significant funding from the city of Prague. So that's why we are sort of Prago-centrist, as we call it. So because we are funded by the city, so we have to focus on doing some stuff in the city. This organization was founded to preserve queer memory and queer history in the Czech lands, which is now the Czech Republic. And we started an archive, we started a museum. Unfortunately, so far, we have been able to collect mostly queer men's history and gay men's history. Unfortunately, we are, of course, aware of that, and we are trying to change that. I would also like to apologize, because what I'm going to talk about are mostly queer men, and I know there's intersectionality in the title of this panel. I'm aware of that, but I didn't sort of choose what panel I'm going to speak on. So I'm aware of that there are going to be a lot of minorities and a lot of communities misrepresented and missing. Even this picture, which is like a random selection from our collection, sort of represented, because except the green dose, the green thing, which depicts some theme from some lesbian erotic motif, all of the other objects are related to gay men and queer men's history or stories. So what we are trying to do in Prague are queer tours around the city. We published in 2013 with a group of historians. We published a tour guide called Queer Prague. We do lectures. We try to put all the lectures together in 1 month. We started April as a queer history month, because in April in 1932, I believe, was published the first queer magazine, the first issue of the first queer magazine in Czechoslovakia. So we sort of selected that as the queer history month. So we do exhibits, usually once a year. We are trying to do some research, and we do some school programs where we show our collections and what we do in the Center for Queer Memory, which is like a small space that is provided by the city of Prague. We started an oral history research. We are trying to interview members of the queer communities. Again, we have mostly represented gay men. We have something about 27 interviews so far. They are supposed to be long and sort of with depth. So each of the interview has sort of about 3-4 hours. We also try to transcribe them, but that's sort of a slow process. I guess you know that. But we started a museum, which is sort of like a museum collection. We have a collection of postcards, collection of artistic objects, collection of audio objects, collection of sort of artifacts, and so forth. We have an archive, which is like donated by single people, single persons, and we are also trying to build a queer history themed library. In April, we are organizing a big conference in November in Prague. The topic is the queering Czech history. You're welcome and encouraged to send a proposal. The deadline is July 15. We would like to see you in Prague in November. So that's sort of a thing that, like a big project for this year that is supposed to encourage new research and also find new researchers and new activists who would like to engage with our institution. However, when we started to create these collections and when we started to put all these objects and artifacts together, there were a couple of questions because all of us at the board board are historians or I'm an art historian, so we were trying to look for some precedents. We were trying to look for some tradition of queer collecting. We were trying to look for some historical strategies of queer collecting. So these questions sort of popped out. So is there something, some history of queer collecting? Of course there is, but how does it look like? What is actually queer about queer collecting? And is there something queer about collecting in general? There are many examples from the history how queer collections were assembled together and then after their owners died, how they were dissolved and how they were, or the, how they were preserved or how they were not preserved, how they were erased. So here's just a random selection of them. Some of them were promoted by Californian art historian Whitney Davis in his work. And of course, I try to include also Gertrude Stein, Stein's collection, which was like one of the most significant ones. The presence of queer artifacts and gay art and objects that are there are sort of supposed to represent and that are so sort of supposed to perform the queer identity are represented throughout genres, throughout media. This is still from some pornographic video, and you can see the queer quite a good collection in the background. However, in the Czech Republic, in the Czech history, we have sort of two very significant queer collectors, male collectors, in the 20th century. This one is the first one that I'm going to show you today. It was a collection of Jiří Karásek Zelvovic. Jiří Karásek Zelvovic was a very famous novelist. He wasn't a professional novelist. Actually, he was a post officer. Almost his entire life. So his entire collection was founded by his own savings from his post office wage. He was a very good novelist. He was sort of in the middle of modernism that was happening in Prague around 1900 and the two or three decades afterwards. He was one of the founding members of a very significant magazine, the Modern Revue, which was a magazine that all the modern artists and novelists and poets were around. He started to write novels. Actually, some of them were very homoerotically explicit. And in 1932, he started the first queer Czechoslovak magazine, Hlas sexuální menšiny, the voice of the sexual minority, and later it was renamed as the new voice, Nový hlas. In 1925, he published this very very interesting and very open, surprisingly very open queer novel, Ganymede, which was about a young guy who was, I think, 16 or 17. He was finding out about his sexuality, sexual identity. He was going through the first love affection for another man, and he sort of describes very deeply and very, very, very thoroughly what he was going through. However, there is this passage about there is this part about his father, who was an art collector, and Jiří Karásek Zelovic sort of expressed that the passion and the desire to collect objects and sort of to create the constellation of history and constellation of representations that would sort of represent someone's queer or non-heteronormative identity is actually linked with sexual identity and sexual orientation. So he wrote that his father was no longer interested in women. That was the most important information that he gives us as the first one. And then he describes how generous and how beautiful his collections were. Jiří Karásek Zavolovič started his own collection, which was sort of supposed to be a very generous, it was supposed to be very big, it was supposed to be very large. Of course, this project never happened. He was trying to collect what he called the Panslavic collection, where he tried to express that there is something about Slavic identity that is unique, that is distinctive, and that is expressed through the modern art. And there was also another small part that was a queer collection. It wasn't displayed publicly, but it was displayed for Karásek's sort of white queer community that he assembled around himself. He also hired a Polish painter, Vlastimil Hoffman, who was quite a well-known painter. He was a pupil of Jacek Malczewski, and he directly ordered queer-themed paintings. Some of them are very large, two to three meters. Paintings that would be part of his homoerotic queer collection. This is the painter. These are some of the drawings, some of the paintings. And Jiří Karásek Zelovic, there is a huge amount of letters stored at the Memorial of National Literature. And as you can see, Jiří Karásek Zelovic drew very exact and very precise compositions how the paintings are supposed to look like, and Vlastimil Hoffman just painted them for him. How this collection was perceived or how it was consumed. As we know, Jiří Karásek Zelovic's collection was first not accessed publicly, but it was accessible for almost anyone who would be interested in it. And we can believe that also the queer collection was sort of not publicly accessible, but it was accessible for everyone who got to knew Karásek and who was invited into his apartment and later into his collection. And so anyone who was sort of part of the queer community around Hlas Sexuální, you mentioned it, magazine, or around the Moderní Revue and other modern queer communities in Prague had access to it. Here we have one testimony of director Václav Krška, who was one generation younger than Karásek, and he, in 1950s, he did this very homoerotic, explicit movie Stříbrný vítr, Silver Wind, and he wrote to Karásek that he loves and admires the Ganymede painting that I showed you earlier. Another collection that I would like to talk about and that I would like to present to you here is a collection that is a little bit that was built up a little bit later. It was assembled by Ladislav Fuchs. Ladislav Fuchs was also a novelist, but again he wasn't able to support himself by his writing. So almost of his life he was employed by the National Heritage Institute, or the institution that is now the National Heritage Institute, and later the National Gallery, which is a fact that is almost forgotten in all literary interpretations of Ladislav Fuchs' work. Ladislav Fuchs started this huge and amazing and very campy and very original and very distinctive collection in his small apartment. As you can see, or as you will see in a minute, the centerpiece of the main living room was a stuffed parrot, which almost everyone who remembers coming to Ladislav Fuchs's apartment remembers. And then there are all these small objects, almost insignificant objects, and they were not worth anything. All these objects and memorabilia that reminded some part of Fuchs's life and work and anything. He again gave us an interpretation of his collection in his last novel, which is sort of really really large novel. It has more than 700 pages, called The Duchess and the Cook, where the Duchess was Ladislav Fuchs's alter ego, and so it was sort of a drag. In impersonation. The Duchess, the main character, is trying to build up a museum, a hotel slash museum that would be, yes, okay, that would be a sort of a representation of everything that's happening in the modern world. In the novel, we have this description. However, this collection was directly connected to Fuchs's previous work at the National Heritage Institute, because he was a curator at the Kinchwart Castle, where there is a huge collection of curiosities from the 18th and the 19th century. Again, some sort of attempt to put together everything from all the different kind parts of the world. This very colonial concept and this very modern concept, to put everything on one place that would represent everything that's happening in the world. So that was a very open inspiration for Fuchs's work. For Fuchs's collection. Also, his collection was supposed to attract his sexual partners. He invited them there, and he tried to impress them with the collection, and also it was queer in the way how Yves Kossowski-Sedwick writes about Marcel Proust's work, because he was living with his old mother, and the mother was supposed to never know. So all these collections, of course, represent the privilege of these gay men or queer men, but of course they are supposed to be a performance, a constellation that is supposed to present their identity and some sort of conserve it for the future generation or future sort of transgress their own lives. So there are these collectors, single collectors or single heritage care protectors that are trying to create some gay collection or collection of gay art, or they are queer and collecting art. So what is the response of the public institutions? How do the public institutions treat the material that can be regarded as queer, and how the public institutions are dealing with it? Of course, the argument that there is no such material in the public institutions, in the museums and the Heritage Care Institute, is no longer sustainable, it's no longer valid. Of course, there is a lot of material, but how is it recognized? How is it presented? So my question was, I used to work at the National Heritage Institute for some time, so I know that there are a lot of gay, especially gay men, but also lesbian women and other minorities working at the Institute. So are they sort of forbidden to do that? Are they sort of not encouraged to do that and present it and sort of work with it? So what is the real nature? I would like to show these two cases of photographs. One is from the National Heritage Institute in the Czech Republic. The other one, it's not just our part of the world. The other one is from Huntington Library in Pasadena, California. And both of these images are recorded, and the caption is this: double portrait of a man and a sitting woman, and the other one is a portrait of an unknown woman in the box that is labeled as female portraits, because it's in the collection of Orrin Peck, who was a painter and a portrait artist. So there are a lot of photographs that were sort of that he did the portraits according to. The first one is actually the same person. It's Ludwig Victor in a dress and in a suit, and the other one is the artist himself in drag. The National Heritage Care professional, I won't mention her name, but she wrote a biography of this forgotten local artist, Ladislav Vlodek, who was associated with the New Voice, Voice of the Sexual Minority magazine. And she asked in this, and apparently she didn't know that fact, and she asked in this biography, I know, one more minute, I'm almost there. She asked the two questions: why did he draw all these young male nudes in his diaries and in his sketchbooks, even if he was 60-plus years old, and why he never married? So her answer was that he wanted to do anatomical exercises even when he was 60-plus years old, and he wanted to fully focus on his artwork. So this ignorance is sort of self-explanatory. So I asked 10 of my former colleagues, gay men professionals in the National Heritage Care Institute, what's going on, why they are not presenting it. So these were their surprising answers. They don't regard it as important. They strictly separate their private life and their professional life, so they don't feel the need to bring out the queer stories and bring out the queer histories. And they just think that, or they want to fit in. Then, of course, some of this problem is rooted in their education, because previously in their lives they were misencouraged to do that at some point. But there are a lot of gay heritage care professionals that just don't want to do it. So we have to, so our task from this is to educate them, not only just the straight people who work in the museums and who are sort of ignorant to these questions and to these problems, but we also have to educate ourselves, queer people who work at the institutions and who are not here and who are not that open as we are. Thank you.
Okay, third speaker is Birgit Bosold from the Schwells. I'm so sorry. She directed prominent exhibition in collaboration with the German Historical Museum and the public history project Queering Holocaust History with Maxim Gorky Theater in the University of Warwick. She's currently directing an international traveling exhibition commemorating the Stonewall Riots, commissioned by the Goethe Institute of North America. And she is talking about the Year of the Woman. Thank you.
Thank you for the introduction. We are going back to intersectionality. I want to present the Year of the Woman, which is really difficult within 15 minutes. We have to rush through the program to have a bit time afterwards to discuss some... Oops, what's now? Okay, we have to rush through the program just to have time afterwards to discuss some small issues. Just some information about Schwules Museum. It was founded in 85, and the most important to know in this context is it was exclusively devoted to male gay art history and culture, and therefore it calls Schwules Museum, which means male gay. In 2017, we decided to run this Year of the Women, and it's also important to know it was like just a decision taken by the board, by everyone in the board, as well as by the team. And the reason is like, you could ask why. Why should this, and the Year of a Woman meant like 1 year specifically female women, asterisk, lesbian, feminist positions within museum. The reason is, you can see the numbers. In 2007, a gay museum decided to open up the perspectives towards all LGBTIQ groups and forces to be represented in the museum. And this is the resume we had to take in 2017. There were about 80 exhibitions, and you can see that more or less 50% of the exhibitions were devoted to specific gay artists, issues, protagonists, and so on. We tried to address sexism and misogyny not only within the organization, the SMU itself and the community, but we also try to address the museums in general as well as the public. It was the time when the Me Too campaign was going on. So there were a lot of reasons to discuss anti-feminism or misogyny, sexism within the cultural industry. The strategy we tried to chose was like addressing or affecting all the layers within the museum. Means the exhibition program for sure, as well as the cafe, as well as the shop, the organization itself, the public relations, and everything. This worked so, but we will talk afterwards about it. So now this very, very fast rush through the program, this was the first exhibition. You can see these little bubbles. We tried to document a bit the criticism which was going on during to this specific exhibition. It was an art exhibition created by our friends from Istanbul, and it was, apart from the issues it was dealing with, it was also like an act of solidarity. As you may know, queer organizations do get a lot of pressure within Turkey today. The second one was a show which has two purposes. First of all, it was trying to open up an intergeneration dialogue, like a conversation between the generations. Within Berlin, you can find a really vital queer feminist, and queer art scene, but they do not know usually that there was also a very, very vital art scene female artists in Berlin in the 80s, in the 70s, as well as before World War II. The next show was like more historical one. It was about the LAZ, Lesbian Action Center, and important to know is that the show was curated by members themselves, which I find the important strategy, which also could be adapted by other museums in general. The next was very similar. It was about BDSM communities, FLT BDSM communities, as well curated by the community itself. The next two shows were like more art shows, Hitra Fantastic and the Extraterrestrial. Both shows were like contemporary art created by the artists themselves and dealt with like important issues which are discussed within the queer feminist discourses today. And the last one was a homage to Mahi Delain, one of the most, or one very important protagonist of the lesbian community in the 80s and 90s. Some ongoing formats, the Dagbar Spirits, the project redesigned the bar, like the cafe of the museum, to a dyke bar, and it was like an ongoing project. It started in April and ended up in the beginning of 2019. And the next one as well, like we also tried to organize a huge like program around, like with workshops, symposiums, art talks, and so on. The most, maybe the most radical format of the whole year was the 12 Moon program. It was curated by my colleague Vera, who can't be here today. And this program had two focuses or two purposes. First of all, to make sure that you can hear every single day a female voice within the museums, within the Schulz Museum, but apart from this, also it focuses or it tries to compensate the gaps within our program, and this also means it focuses on the gaps. It makes them visible. This was some pictures, or these are some pictures from the opening, and we found ourselves immediately within the eye of a shitstorm. why do I call it shitstorm? Because it was not only critique, it was really kind of really massive, it was ongoing, it was some of this critique at least was really very aggressive, and it comes from like within the museum itself, from people within the museum, but also within the community. Even though the year was very, very successful, we had the best financial returns ever. The 2015 was an exceptional year because of the enormous budgets of the major show, Homosexualities. And we also had as well, really, in regarding the numbers of visitors, the best result. But it was not only the numbers which was which we understand like as a success. It was also that we could attract numerous groups of new people coming to us. A lot of them, the first time ever, and so we do have like we could create like a different network of visitors, partners, curators, academic, of stakeholders in general. So now I try to identify this identify some conflict or some lines of conflict within this whole discussion around the Year of the Women. We were talking in some of the lectures I was attending in the conference. Some other people did also talked about conflict, generation conflicts. I don't know if this is a good way to frame it, because maybe it also hides something, namely that generation conflicts are also political conflicts. It's about resources, money, sovereignty of interpretation, and so on, and maybe it's also about political programs. For example, you could say radical change versus respectability. The second conflict is lesbian invisibility. Again, I would say the framing of this conflict hides the picture, because it's not about visibility. It's about, again, resources, money, impact, and so on. And what I find interesting, and also in this conference, why do we not actually name this and discuss it as such? Why do we talk about invisibility or diversity? It's not about, and the last one, okay, one numbers again, statistics. This like wonderful cake is about the funding the state of Berlin distributes into the queer community. And you can, this is 2017, but the years before, like 10 years are documented, like from 7 to 17, and the years before it was the same. Mainly, more or less 50% of the money goes to institutions which are controlled by gay kind of stakeholders. So the last one is fighting queer feminism, and it means double, fighting against and defighting queer feminism. To formulate a thesis, like the background of the current conflicts in the SMU has to do with the campaign against the so-called queer feminism within the queer community, which is going on for like some years. And these attacks are linked with attacks you can find, or with rhetoric at least, you can find in conservative media, like the FAZ, Frankfurter Allgemeine, against political correctness in general, but specifically also against intersectional policy theorists, and also against academic gender studies in particular. I just two quotes to illustrate a bit. Queer feminism is supposed to be like an import from the United States, and it deals somehow with authoritarian prohibitions and so on. What is the thing? My last, ich bin in der Zeit. Thank you. Okay. Like one reflection, it's completely sure that this has to do with the changes which were going on the last 20 years, 10 years. it's for sure the digital media. They really changed the way we communicate in public, but also privately. And the second is that I think this harsh conflicts, they also show that a bit of power, that power structure have changed a bit. Some of these previously marginalized people could make it somehow to get positions within the universities, but also within queer community organizations. So, and now this is I want to discuss with you, and hope we can do it. Are these conflicts well known to you in your organizations? Are we behind somehow or in advance? We can discuss it. And the next question is how to deal with this. Maybe you have any ideas. Thank you so much.
And lastly is Jonathan Dory, who has been our tech support as well. And I'll let you just get up here since you're here. Okay. I lost it now. Hold on. He's a lecturer in information studies at McGill University in Montreal, and he started looking into archives as tools that help shape and reshape identity and memory, particularly following trauma or when dealing with mental illness. He's a board member of the Archives Gay du Québec and the Association of Canadian Archivists. This paper was prepared in collaboration with Julie Podmore, a professor of geography, John Abbott College, and at Concordia University in Montreal, a board member of the Archives since 2014. Okay, good. So we have about 15 minutes for discussion. Does anyone have a question maybe in the realm of talking about resistance within our own communities to diversifying our collections? Or any other topics? Person over there.
Thank you very much, Birgit, to bring up this conflict and also hierarchies inside among the queer community, or LG and B and T, like the very separate communities also. Being a young queer historian, I would like to ask how do we actually think queer memory and queer history is going on when there are also these political differences between the not only generations, but between the different waves of feminism and, I'm the future memory generation writing history of lesbian, cis-lesbian women who always wanted to be this, and, there are new critical approaches, and I'm wondering, I'm in the dilemma of there's not much lesbian history being written yet, but still I want to also bring in queer perspectives and maybe, what do you think the future will bring with this power dynamics? Thank you.
Yeah, the future will hopefully be queer feminist. I think it's, I totally agree. I think it's very, very important to create spaces for intergenerational discussions more than we did before. I think it's very, very difficult, or it's for me it's important to talk about the conflicts and to describe them, because even though that it will cause more conflict if you name it, I think it's important to just really to name that, because what I think is if you really want to build alliances or communities, you need to name precisely the conflicts, otherwise you can't find any like solutions or any whatever coalitions. And regarding how to write history, I think it's really difficult because like you will have these conflicts if you talk with like the first wave generation, you will have this conflict, oh, I was always lesbian and queer as bullshit and whatever. But in the same time, you also will find traces from lesbian people, and I'm one of these. I can't understand the conflict in a way, because for me, lesbian identity always meant non-binary, like kind of non-binary access, like idea of identity. And you also would find and will find people, also people in the gay community. There was a feminist, a feminist party within the gay community in the 70s, and it would be really nice to recover them or something like this. And the same within Monique Wittig, you know, all these people working on these questions. And I think it's also important to secure these traces, not only the conflict ones.
Hi, I was really interested in your discussion, Birgit, of the of framing this as a question of not only visibility or lack thereof, but also a question of access to resources and funding and space, and sort of that there's a material element to this that gets glossed over. And I guess I'm wondering how. Maybe this is a slightly different question, but I guess I'm wondering, like, is there a role that queer men can play in solidarity in trying to address that issue? I mean, I feel like so much of this has been framed in terms of women are on one side and men are on another. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's true or not, and I guess I'm just wondering what your perspective is on that.
I totally agree. It was a question to me?
Yeah.
Okay. I totally agree. We are discussing about creating a format or like a lecture series or whatever, precisely to discuss this question: what can solidarity mean, not only towards like women and lesbian, but also towards trans women, trans men, towards POC people, towards all the other marginalized minorities who are part of the community. And can you invite you, please talk with Mike and Chris and create this space. I really appreciate that very much.
Hi, I really don't have answers here either, obviously, but I volunteer in an archive in Munich, and we're still called Forum Homosexualität, so we're also having this discussion of like renaming, and I feel like it is that generation conflict, but I think that fostering spaces where we all talk to each other to try to figure out what the fears of the people are too, because I feel like we have a lot of older lesbian members that are afraid of just becoming invisible if we change the name, and I think that's a valid fear. And then younger people, however, especially being an archive, I think the conflict is like we still need these people that are older now. We want their collections. We want to preserve their history. But at the same time, it's the younger people that are the future of the organization. So if you don't want the organization to die out, we need to bring these people in to work for us and volunteer for us and do it. And I think that's a big conflict and obviously no solution. But I think trying to talk to each other and trying to figure out what the fears are of each of these groups or why they don't feel represented or understood is probably the best way we can do.
Hi, thank you for your talks. I'm interested that this panel, I do have the book that, like, I know it's the thing in the book is a bit out of date, but this panel is listed as intersectional perspectives. And something I'm really interested in is that, like, we have an almost entirely, like, white panel. I'm sorry, I missed the earlier talk, so I don't know how some of you might identify, and maybe you are part of the, like, you would consider yourself people of color, and I missed that bit. But how are we having intersectional conversations if no one on the panel represents communities that we are struggling to engage with? And in this spirit as well, like, I really enjoyed the talks, but just like being careful that, like, being POC, like being a person of color is not a, like, sexual identity. There was like one or two pie charts where, like, identities were called out as being like gay, lesbian, trans, or POC, and that completely like removes the identity of people who are POC and gay or POC and trans. And I think, like, we just have to be really careful about who we're centering in these conversations, and, like, what those voices aren't included, and we're still not making space for them. And I was wondering if in your work, how are you bringing these people to be leaders and to be the people who are running these organizations and making that change?
I don't have an answer for you because I don't know how to do it myself. One collection we've acquired, I've mentioned Rainbow Africa. One other collection we've acquired recently is an organization that was of queer deaf members. They folded. For many of the reasons that most associations nowadays are folding, for lack of involvement from new members, which is, to paraphrase what you were saying, a way of expressing an idea that I don't like, because we sort of put the blame on the young ones to voluntarily not volunteer, as opposed to looking at it from they physically, financially, socially cannot volunteer their time. They're trying to make ends meet. So to put the pressure on the younger generation to do this is a lot of pressure on them. In the case of the Queer Deaf Association, we have a friend of mine who I studied with is a librarian. He's deaf. He's a librarian. He's the first gay deaf, first deaf librarian or librarian who is deaf working in Montreal and probably in the rest of the province. He's offered to process this collection, and he's going at it very slowly because he understands this collection. He also understands the way the collection is documented. Now, keeping in mind that in the case of deaf people, the written language is not their mother tongue. Their mother tongue is a sign language that has a different syntax and so on. So when they write something, it's often not the way they would necessarily have written it. So having that perspective is important. That doesn't include your or answer your question, but like I said, I don't have an answer. And I also do not want to bring someone and that person being forced to be the token gay archivist or the token black archivist or the token lesbian archivist in the institution. And recognizing that there's this issue as well of being the first one to be involved or the first one, and that is also another pressure that most people don't need. I would say make space for them somehow. Force yourself to make space, like remove yourself if you need to.
Yeah, thank you for the question, and it's a valid question as well, of course. It's not an easy question to ask, and it's a question we also struggle with in my organization right now, because we deal with so many different minority issues and so many different questions when we talk about inclusion and accessibility. And of course, we can't have everybody represented in the office as well. We don't have so many people working with us. But for example, in this project, we try to give since the main. When we're talking about Finland 100, the main the target group were the institutions, then we try to give them information about organizations and people from different communities that they could cooperate with. So that was one way. And we were also, for example, in the art project, that was an art project that where they worked with different kind of communities, and the artists themselves were also represented different minorities as well. So yeah, giving space and giving is the answer. But also giving information to those organizations that do not have that kind of knowledge.
I wanted to say, we didn't put this panel together because I was very surprised not to find ourselves within these lesbian slots, because it's like, I don't know why it is, why we are part of the intersectional panel. I would say it would have benefited in this different lesbian slots. So.
Yeah, but I could just answer, give one response to your question, even though it was an arbitrarily put together panel, in that, I mean, in my work, since I don't work in a community archives per se, I'm just the single person. I always know that I can't be every kind of person, but that it's my job to preserve every kind of history. And one thing that I think is important to do is to get beyond the kind of, at least in the U.S., the white person's victim-y kind of powerless response of, like, I'd like to do this, but I just can't, you know. I don't know how. And so I've been very active in pushing for change within the library and the university I work with, working with diversity, inclusion, and belonging groups. And I just want to throw out one idea, is that in our social media, like if you think about Instagram, how you often see, you know, a window of 9 images, I suggested this year that whenever anyone look at our Instagram feed, they need to see at least one person of color and at least one gender non-variant person. It'd be great if there was more, but that kind of visibility, that we just, someone walking into the library shouldn't have the perception that it's all about white history or it's all white people. So I do that myself on my Instagram page for work, but I haven't been able to get buy-in from the university yet. They say, you know, oh yeah, well, diversity is really important, but somehow they balked at that idea of actually committing to representing different people regularly. But maybe you can propose a session for the next conference and we can delve into it. Do we have time for one more question? No, we don't. I'm sorry. And it is my responsibility to tell you two things. One, if you want to be part of the big group photo, please gather at 18:15, which for some of us is 6:15. Yes. And on the large steps above the pond for the group photo. And they'll snap the picture at 6:30. And lastly, on your way out, if you don't want to take your lanyard home with you or the big yellow program book, please leave it at the information booth, where I guess they'll recycle them. And thank you for all the panelists and all of you for coming.